This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Samantha Bee, is the most senior correspondent for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. She joined the show in 2003. Her husband, Jason Jones, became a contributor 2 years later. They have two children together, with a third on the way. Now Samantha Bee has a new memoir about growing up in Canada in an unconventional family called I Know I Am, But What Are You? Let's start with a clip from The Daily Show from a couple of years ago. It had just been reported that Eliot Spitzer, then governor of New York, had been a client in a prostitution ring. At a press conference, Spitzer admitted he'd violated the trust of his family. Standing at his side was his wife. Jon Stewart said that Spitzer had just joined the shame parade of politicians caught cheating on their spouses. And Spitzer followed the simple rule of public humiliation, bring a date. Here's Samantha Bee's report. Midway through it, she's joined by her husband, Jason Jones.
We have seen this time and time again. A bad actor with his supportive spouse by his side.
You know, if there's one business event your spouse should probably be excused from, it's the one where you explain how you've betrayed them. I mean, what does someone even wear for that? Does this skirt make my ass look humiliated?
It is mind-blowing that they always have their wife by their side. It seems like cruelty piled upon cruelty.
Yes, exactly. If anything, let the hooker stand up there. She's the one everyone wants to see, ladies. Am I right? Please.
Well, now, Sam, that's a good point. There are rumors, though, that the governor is negotiating his resignation. What are your sources telling you about that?
I don't really know. I haven't been really paying any attention, so...
I asked you to cover this last night to get the...
Yeah, I know. I was out, so I didn't really
you were out?
Do that.
What do you mean you were out?
Yeah, at a club. Like a private club. I'm sorry, just hold on a second. Babe, get out. John, I need to make a brief statement. Last night, I engaged in activities that failed to live up to the high standards I set for myself as a wife. I was with a group of men. Maybe a lady or two, I don't really remember. Definitely, though, several men. It was a betrayal of my marriage. Even if it left me satisfied in a way my husband, who you see next to me, never has.
Sam, this is not an appropriate
forum. No, please. I owe it to Jason, whom I love more than life itself, mostly as a friend, to confess my infidelity, my breaking of his heart to the entire world. I also apologize to our daughter. I think our, definitely mine.
That's my guest, Samantha Bee, with Jon Stewart. And standing at her side in that sketch is her actual husband, Jason Jones, who is also a regular on The Daily Show. And he is wearing a women's blazer with pearls. Samantha Bee, you are so funny. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh,
I am so happy to have you on our show.
I can't tell you how happy I am to be here.
And congratulations on your new memoir, I Know I Am, But What Are You? As we just heard, you work with your husband, Jason Jones, on The Daily Show, but you come from a long line of divorced people. So I'd like you to read an excerpt from your new memoir about that. So here's a reading from Samantha Bee's new book, I Know I Am, But What Are You?
Okay. Our family legacy of failed marriage dates back to the era in which women whose behavior vaguely pushed the boundaries of social acceptability were automatically considered either mentally deficient or, more likely, hookers. If you wanted to be an actor, for example, that was just an artsy way of saying, I'd do it for money. If you opted to have a job, then you may have been a career gal by day, but everyone knew it was probably just a front for your nighttime hookering. And if you dared to get a divorce, then you were indisputably a hooker, and God bless the poor husband who had to put up with you for so long, you horrible floozy. The women in my family were often suspected of this kind of sluttery, but the glorious truth is that they mostly just love to marry sadists. Men who like to beat them up physically or psychologically, drink up all the food money, start a side family, and then proceed to drink up all their new family's food money, too. It was quite a collection of gentlemen that the women on both sides of my family had collectively cast aside. I'm sure they would have endured any tawdry accusations with relish if those accusations had been accompanied by divorce papers. Dating from well before the turn of the 20th century, if there has ever been a successful, happy marriage in my family lineage, I've yet to hear about it.
You know, it's amazing hearing about that history of divorce and an unhappy marriage in your family. And you have such a public marriage because you work with your husband, Jason Jones.
I know. It's just a front. I know. I really it's really sad because, you know, Jason comes from a very tight-knit family, a large family, and this is not their narrative. So I was nervous that his family would find out about my backstory and think that I was not trustworthy.
Now, your memoir is about growing up with your mother, your stepfather, your father, your stepmother,
yeah,
plus grandmother and great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people to answer to.
A lot of people to answer to, and it was just me. I'm an only child, so I was like a little miniature adult at a very early age.
It must have been really confusing because it sounds like your mother was really into a very open idea of what what childhood should be and when a child should learn about sex, whereas like your father and stepmother were much more conservative about that, as I imagine your grandmother was too. It just sounds so confusing.
It was confusing. Listen, it's not a sad story by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, there was always love in the home, whatever that home consisted of at the time. But I never knew who I was. I was a different person in everybody's home. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
I changed myself depending on whose house I was living at. I was most myself at my grandmother's, I would say.
What were some of the changes from house to house?
Well, my father and my stepmother, and, you know, believe me, I love them, but they were a lot more high maintenance. You know, they expected a lot of childness from me that I was really not, capable of. I mean, I was just used to being people who treated me in a more adult way and allowed me to have, you know, preferences and, you know, things I didn't want to do just didn't seem important to them. But when I was at my father and my stepmother's home, they just really expected me to want to do things like ride a bicycle, play jacks, talk to other children. I was just so unfamiliar with that. It was really like being thrown into a den of lions. I was not physical or competitive or really interested in talking to other kids. I was very so shy.
Now, you write that your mother thought it was unhealthy to prolong childhood past the age of 7, and she taught you the facts of life pretty early with the help of a book that she gave you. Tell us what the book was like. It sounds like a very odd book to give a child.
It really is not meant for children, but she just tossed it at me one day. She just decided that it was time for me to learn all about sex, to learn all about the terms for every sexual proclivity in existence. And, you know, I was playing with my dollies at the time. I mean, I was getting them ready for bed, putting their hair in pin curls, and she just sort of tossed it at me. It was this little red book, and it just described every sex act. It wasn't a scientific book. It was just a book that described every sex act imaginable. And I was an avid reader. So I opened up the book and I started reading. And then I had questions. I actually called when I was writing this book, I called my mother, and because I was trying to track down the book, I wanted to know if she still had it. And she had gotten rid of it for whatever reason. Maybe she lost it in a move. But we both lamented that. It would have been great to have. Well, I'd love to give it to my children.
Oh, sure.
Probably hit them with it when they're around 6, as soon as they can start to read.
My guest is Samantha Bee. She's a correspondent on The Daily Show and author of a new memoir called I Know I Am, But What Are You? You're a working woman, you know, on The Daily Show. And three children is a lot, I think, for somebody with a career.
It is, but I have to say, The Daily Show could not be more accommodating. It really is a very family-friendly place to work. And I think maybe that would surprise people, maybe it wouldn't. But they are great about it. They're happy when people have children there. It's nobody goes into distress or lockdown mode. Everybody seems so warm. Everybody's very warm and embracing. And, you know, they've been so accommodating with us, bringing our children with us when we go away. When we went to the conventions in 2008, I actually brought both my kids. Fletcher had just been born. He was only 8 weeks old. And we carted him off to Denver, and everybody was so great about it. So they really make it possible for us to, and they're just, they could not be more wonderful. And actually, it's very helpful. It's really nice that they hired Jason, because that makes it a lot easier on me. Well, because we have adult time together. Being at work is kind of like being on a date, minus the sex.
I get it. You've done field work, for instance, at the National Republican Convention, where you did a piece trying to get Republicans to say the word choice.
Oh my, that was an incredible experience.
I want you to talk about that. Describe the piece, first of all, for listeners who haven't heard it.
Well, I don't know if I can describe it as well as someone who hasn't seen it, because we were on such a Daily Show. I don't really remember things well, but I do remember the main purpose of the piece was to get all of those people to say the word choice. It was like they had.
Well, I should stop here and say this was right after Sarah Palin had given her address at the convention, and people at this point knew that her daughter was pregnant and that her daughter had decided to carry to term. I mean, there's absolutely no question of abortion here.
They kept talking about making a choice to, you know, in their case, you know, in her case, to keep the baby, when really all they really seemed to be planning to do was take away everybody's choice and not make it a choice at all. So choice became this key word, you know, in all of their speeches and directives and internal memos and things. It seemed like they were trying to eradicate the word completely because we couldn't get people to say it. We just couldn't get people to say it. They just kind of went around and around and around and around and around without saying it. So we interviewed so many people and they just wouldn't say the word choice.
So in this excerpt, Samantha Bee is interviewing several people trying to get them to say the word choice.
She said no, it's a human being.
She made, the decision. There's another word I'm looking for. It rhymes with voice. Every family and every woman should have the right to, it's her family, it's her, what is the word I'm looking for? It's like an alternative. Or if you have two things, you be Sarah Palin and I'll be her 17-year-old daughter.
Bristol, you know, you and I have always been able to openly discuss things.
What do you want to talk to me about? I'm totally busy right now, Mom. Can you get out of my room?
It's like when you have a lot of options and you have to select one. What's the word I'm looking for? What is the word?
Adoption is one.
No, there's a specific word I'm looking for.
I'm sure the family will be able to make the best decision for them.
But they'll have the freedom to make that decision. Hold on a second. I'm talking to my boyfriend. Can I call you back? My mom is in my room. She wants to talk to me about something. Hold on. I'll call you back.
Well, yes, but I don't think that the... I don't think that the decision, I think it should be not, I think that the family decision would become as how, yes, okay.
It's, you know, when you have like an alternative, what's the word I'm looking for? Alternative,
A different choice?
Choice, yes, exactly. Every family, every person should have the choice to decide what's best for them.
That's Samantha Bee at the Republican National Convention after Sarah Palin gave her address. And that's, of course, from The Daily Show, where she's a correspondent. Now she also has a new memoir called I Know I Am, But What Are You? So there you were at the convention, at the Republican mm-hmm. National Convention, interviewing people, trying to get them to say the word choice, which you mm-hmm. thought had basically been eradicated from their vocabulary.
It felt like it had been. Yeah. It was like pulling teeth.
So what did you tell them? Like, each of those people who you interviewed, did you say, I'm with The Daily Show, it's a comedy show, we're doing, you know, how did you say who you were and what the point of the interview was?
Well, that's what we, you know, when it's something like that and we're at a convention and we're just talking to people, you know, quickly, we're just grabbing person after person to see if they'll talk to us. We always tell them where we're from, and we don't necessarily tell them, we don't tell them the questions that we're going to ask them.
Do you say Comedy Central or do you just say The Daily
yeah,
Show? Comedy Central.
Of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yes, they know where we come from. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that they know the show. Many of them know the reputation of the show,
uh-huh.
not the show specifically. They don't necessarily watch it.
So let me quote from your memoir, I Know I Am, But What Are You? You write, hitting puberty excavated a wellspring of evil energy in me that led me to the discovery that my parents were vulnerable and had made mistakes that could be exploited in an interesting way. I was a scary teenager. My parents mm-hmm. should have been much more scared than they actually were. Why should they have been more scared? What made you so scary?
Well, I was a terrible teenager. I, you know, at the beginning of my teendom, I took these terrible risks. I did all these things that children, that you would just shake in your boots if you knew that your daughter was doing these things. And none of it involved, you know, copious amounts of sex and drugs at that time. But I would just go to men's homes. Like, you know, I was just a young girl, you know, 13, 14. I had braces on my teeth. I mean, it was just so obvious that I was a young girl. But men approached me a lot. Grown men approached me a lot and invited me to things and places and their homes. And I would just go. I don't really know. It was the most unwise decision. I can't believe I emerged from that unscathed. I start to sweat. I was talking about it. I immediately began to perspire thinking about my daughter going to men's homes. I mean, it's just awful. And then at the end of that, I sort of spontaneously grew a backbone. I don't really know what happened, but one day I just kind of realized that was probably not the best technique for staying alive or intact. I mean, I was completely at their mercy in places I didn't know where I was, you know, in basement apartments.
Where did you go? Do you have any idea?
You know, I think really it boils down to the fact that I was such a people pleaser growing up that I was really just afraid to say no to people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think a lot of us suffer from that. But I really did. I really did have an inability to turn people down. It's ridiculous. I've since learned how to say no. But at the time, and then I met a boy my own age, who led me astray, and you know, we began this whole criminal enterprise. So we had this whole underground. You know, it wasn't a crime syndicate, but we were doing all of this stuff that was just terrible. And
such as?
In the end, oh, we became car thieves. I mean, to an almost professional degree. We were stealing cars and fencing the goods from cars and throwing wild parties. This is ridiculous. We were kids. I mean, I didn't even have my driver's license, but I was driving.
you weren't other people's you weren't cars. Terrified of getting caught or morally guilty about what you were doing?
We just had this unbelievable narcissism. Like, we just didn't even imagine that we would get caught. We did it for, I'm going to say, maybe a year and a half, something like that. It didn't go on forever. No, I really didn't develop a sense for the morality of it until a little bit later in life,
when people stole things from me. And I thought, I don't deserve this. What happened? What are you doing? And then I made those connections a little bit later in life. I think I just was in that kind of teen state where you don't really value property and you think that things are easy to come by. It really is just kind of hopefully it just remains with people in their teens. But I didn't really have respect for things.
You've done a sketch or two satirizing the Catholic Church and the Pope,
mm-hmm.
and you went to Catholic school.
I did.
Which you write about in your memoir. So is it hard to satirize the Church and the Pope having gone to Catholic school?
Oh, heavens no. I'm a lapsed Catholic, Terry, a terribly lapsed Catholic. So it is joyful for me to do that. That is pure pleasure for me, I will say. In fact, I'm working on a piece right now that is related to the Catholic Church. And it's fascinating to me. I don't have any of that Catholic guilt. I've worked my way through that. There's none of that left.
Now, you write in your memoir that your Catholic school was considered a progressive Catholic school. What did
it
that mean?
It was a progressive Catholic school. We did not, we had Seder meals and those adorable traditions from other religions. We just learned about other religions and other cultures, and that was just an important part of our, when we had to take a religion course, of course, but it wasn't just our religion. It was quite inclusive, and we didn't wear uniforms, and we had to go to church occasionally, but it wasn't a huge part of our curriculum, and we didn't have big, gory Jesuses everywhere. They were monochromatic, so you couldn't see the blood dripping from the wounds of Jesus. But, you know, my Catholic Church was fairly modern. It was on the modern side. I mean, listen, it's not that modern, but as Catholic churches go, it was kind of on the more modern edge.
You say that the Jesuses that were pictured in your school looked more like Kris Kristofferson circa A Star Is Born.
Sure. Very.
And that you had a crush on
sensual.
Jesus.
I don't know. You know, I've spoken to a lot of lapsed Catholics since I wrote the book, and we all had a crush on Jesus. I mean, he was really designed that way for young girls to find him sexy and attractive. I mean, did you ever see the miniseries? You know, the miniseries Jesus of Nazareth? I mean, that
was that the one with Rubenstein? What's his first name? John Rubenstein?
Okay. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know any of their names. I just can really instantly recall the face of the guy who played Jesus in Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, that was a really important part of it for me. I wouldn't have been interested in it at all if he hadn't been, you know, had dazzling, dazzling blue eyes and wonderful silky hair. I mean, would any of us?
So what did it mean to have a crush on Jesus?
I don't know that it, you know, I don't know that it meant anything to my present life. It caused in my family conflict because my mother is Wiccan, and she became very concerned about me and my love for Jesus because I really, you know, just like all the other girls, I really wanted to marry him, and I thought a lot about what would happen if he materialized in front of me. You know, would I be prepared to get down on my hands and knees and wash his feet? You're supposed to wash his feet, dry them with your hair. You know, there are all these rituals that you're supposed to do, but ultimately the goal is, you know, to be together. And she did become concerned about my kind of my approach to that and my obsession with him. And I didn't really have like rock posters in my bedroom. I had Jesus, a big Jesus above my bed. She found it really repellent. My father is just a complete atheist and my mother is into Wicca. So she decided that she felt compelled to introduce me to some other stuff. So she made me go to like a Wiccan mass, which was just horrible for me. It was just terrifying.
We should explain that Wiccan means more of a kind of contemporary kind of feminist spiritual approach to witchcraft.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. It was very important to her. It has always been very important to her. But to me, it was just satanic. because I just thought it was. It was just the people sort of looked vaguely. It was just too counterculture for me. But she, you know, she made me go and attend some rituals, and it was terrifying. I found it just terrifying.
You know, I've known people who've been into Wicca, but I've never mm-hmm. really known the child of somebody who's been into it. And I've always wondered mm-hmm. what it's like to be the child of somebody who has beliefs that are considered like far out of the mainstream like that.
Well, when I kind of felt sorry for my mother when I was growing up because I was so into Jesus. I thought, oh, this poor Lamb of God, she doesn't understand. She just doesn't get it. but now, I mean, you know, I'm proud of my mom. She's stuck with it. You know, lots of people don't stick with it, but she's always had her little amulets. That's terrible. But she's always had her rituals and the things that she does. It's really an important part of her life. And so I respect the fact that she's stuck with something now. It's not for me. It's not for my husband. But she loves it. And so I wouldn't say that it's not horrible or terrifying. It's not very intrusive when you're growing up. It's the most unintrusive religious practice imaginable. It's very not in your face. It's kind of a private thing, and people gather on the wrong side of the tracks to practice whatever it is that they're doing. being a child of Wicca has not affected me negatively. And you get to know a lot about plants. All avid gardeners.
When I use the word witchcraft, is that okay, or is that an inappropriate word? I want to make sure I get it right.
Well, I'm not so savvy on the particulars. I think it's okay. They're white, you know, they're kind of white witches.
Okay.
Good. I did learn recently that the word warlock is outdated. Nobody's calling the male witches warlocks, because I made some reference to my mom's husband as a warlock, and she was like, oh, he's a male witch. Can you please not call him a warlock?
Okay.
So, you know, let everybody know, warlock.
Out.
Very passe. Out.
How did you get into comedy?
I came to it very late in life. It was not a goal of mine. I did think that I was going to, you know, in the midst of all of this, you know, terrible teenagehood, I was still kind of scholarly. Good grades were very important to me. I went to college, and I thought that I would go to law school. So I was preparing for my LSATs, and I ended up taking a theater course very spontaneously, and because I thought that it was going to be so easy and a breeze and that I would just blow it off and still get an amazing grade and boost my GPA. And then I kind of liked it. There was something intriguing about it, and you had to do outside work. You had to do, you know, you had to volunteer to, you know, be in the on the stage crew or whatever as part of this class. And so I auditioned for a part. It was a Brecht play. And I got a part, and I didn't even read the whole play. I just did my part in the play. And I loved it. I had to sing. It was, you know, it was a kind of a good part. And it just connected with me. It just connected with me. So then I thought, well, I'm going to be an actor. So I totally refocused all my energy into becoming a very, very serious actor. And then nobody would ever hire me as that because, you know, just wanting to be a good serious actor does not make you a good serious actor. I think I'm terrible at it or something. And so I struggled with that for many years. Nobody would ever hire me for anything. And then I became connected to some people through children's theater who were doing comedy. And they asked me to fill in for someone, you know, doing some sketch one night at a grouty bar in Toronto. And I did it, and I loved it. I just loved it. It just, everything kind of made sense to me when I was on stage doing comedy. I got all that applause, approval that I had been craving all those years, and laughter too, which was much better than tears to me in the end. And then I started doing comedy.
Samantha Bee, I think you're so wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with us.
This was such a pleasure. I just love this show, and I'm just so appreciative that you had me on. I can't even tell you.
Samantha Bee. She's a correspondent for The Daily Show and author of the new memoir, I Know I Am, But What Are You? The new documentary, The Oath, is about two men who were close to Osama bin Laden before 9/11. Abu Jandal was a jihadist who recruited Salim Hamdan. Jandal became bin Laden's bodyguard. Hamdan became bin Laden's driver. At the suggestion of bin Laden, the men married sisters, making the two men brothers-in-law. The two men's paths diverged before 9/11 when they left bin Laden. Jandal was in prison in Yemen in 2001. He was interrogated there by an American and gave up key information. After his release, he became a taxi driver. Hamdan was captured in Afghanistan, then taken to Guantanamo Bay, where he became the first detainee to face a military tribunal. He was also the plaintiff in the Supreme Court case Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, challenging the legality of military tribunals. Hamdan was released after 7 years and returned to custody in Yemen to serve out the remainder of his sentence, which ended in late 2008. My guest, Laura Poitras, filmed her documentary, The Oath, in Yemen. It's the second in her planned trilogy of post-9/11 films. Most of The Oath focuses on Abu Jandal. Hamdan declined to speak with her. She tells his story through his letters from Gitmo and his defense attorneys. Given Abu Jandal's history, how did you convince him not only to talk with you, but to allow you to film him?
I think there are multiple reasons that he, agreed to be filmed. I think he actually feels very guilty about the fact that he recruited Salim Hamdan and that Hamdan was at Guantanamo and he was free. And I think it helped. I'd made a film about the war in Iraq, and I gave him that film. And I think that that also helped getting the kind of access that I needed.
He's actually a very important figure in the larger story of terrorism and counterterrorism. And he was interrogated after 9/11, and he became one of the really important people to give up information to American intelligence. Can you talk about how he ended up being interrogated and what he offered?
Right. He was, in 2000, he was imprisoned in Yemen. So he was in Yemen prison on 9/11. And after the attacks, FBI agent Ali Soufan, who many people might be aware of, he's written several op-eds speaking out against torture. And Ali Soufan was in Yemen and was asked to speak to people to try to find out information about the attack. And 6 days after 9/11, entered Abu Jandal's cell. And a two-week interrogation ensued. And it's a very significant interrogation. I mean, some people think it's one of the most important post-9/11 interrogations. And one of the things that's quite extraordinary about it. It was done with Miranda rights and by the book, and actually delayed the invasion of Afghanistan
because they didn't want to start until they were finished.
Because
interrogating
there was so
him because he was giving so much useful information. He was the one who identified all of the suspects from 9/11. He'd worked with them. He knew them.
Right. Yeah, he ran a guest house in Afghanistan, so he would receive guys, and there were several that the government knew who they were, but there were a lot of people on the planes whose names they didn't know. So he was able to identify them.
So Abu Jandal becomes the kind of model of interrogation where you get information without torture or extreme techniques. And his interrogators, he's diabetic. His interrogators brought him sugar-free soda and sugar-free food for him to eat. He talks about how they tried to win him over, and I guess they succeeded.
I mean, I've spent time with both men. Unfortunately, Ali Soufan couldn't participate in an interview for the film, but he testifies at the Senate as speaking out against the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. And they're both pretty extraordinary men, very intelligent, both, I think, very skilled men at persuasion. And, what happens in this interrogation is that at first, Abu Jandal doesn't believe that the 9/11 attacks were committed by al-Qaeda.
And then he sees the pictures of the suspects and he starts to weep because he knows them all. Would you trace his trajectory for us about how he became a member of al-Qaeda and ended up joining bin Laden?
So Abu Jandal is born of Yemeni parents, but he's born in Saudi Arabia, in Jeddah. And as he was growing up, he talks about being influenced by the people who fought in Afghanistan during the Mujahideen and against the Soviets. And as a young boy, being impressed by these men who had fought. And what inspired him to leave home was the what was happening in Bosnia. So at the age of 19, he packed his bags, told his dad he was going to be, you know, playing soccer with his friends, met a friend of his, and went to Bosnia and fought there for about a year. And then
fought with the Muslims there.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And was trained there. And then he went into Somalia. And he was there for a short time, went through Yemen. It was in Yemen that he met Salim Hamdan. And, Hamdan was, very different than Abu Jandal. Abu Jandal was very ideologically motivated, jihadi, was looking for to engage in jihad, as he would define it, defending Muslims. And Salim Hamdan, by contrast, was, a Yemeni guy who didn't have a place to live or a job. And Abu Jandal recruits him and takes him on his way to Tajikistan. And as they are going through Afghanistan, bin Laden had just left the Sudan and invited that group to come and visit. And it was in that invitation that he invited them to stay. And Abu Jandal went on to become bin Laden's bodyguard and Salim Hamdan the driver. This would have been in 96.
So do you know why he was disillusioned when he was working for bin Laden?
I think he felt that the tactics were wrong, that a targeting of civilians was not what he wanted to engage with.
And we should say it's not like he's opposed to the jihad. He still believes mm-hmm. in jihad. He just believes it should be a battle on the battlefield and not killing civilians in planes or buildings.
Right, right. There's a point in the film where I ask him about this question, and that's what he says, is that he doesn't personally believe in targeting civilians, but he believes in and fighting on the battlefield.
Which makes him, I'm sure, a very ambiguous figure for you and for us, the viewers, because on the one hand, there's something really sympathetic as we're watching him in the movie. He's charismatic. He's very articulate, very persuasive, very energetic. He has a kind of almost a comic gleam in his eye sometimes. He really engages with people. He has a warmth about him. He's renounced bin Laden's tactics. At the same time, he still believes in jihad. It's just that it should be on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as a filmmaker, I mean, that what was really interesting about this person. I mean, it felt that he was really conflicted. We wanted the audience to sort of be drawn into his charisma because that's how, this is a guy who ran a guest house, and so, and you see in the film.
For bin Laden, yeah.
For bin Laden in Afghanistan. And now he greets, young men seek him out for teaching. So he receives these young men and they sort of sit around and there's these sort of teachings that happen. So we want the viewer to sort of be drawn into, he has this sort of a kind of a power, and he actually talks about it, the art of influencing people. We show that he's also a very good liar and that he's very media savvy. And so there's a bit of a push-pull between, drawing you in and also giving you clues of, don't always trust what you're hearing and also make you, question what you're listening to.
Well, if you don't mind my bringing this up, the scene I think you're referring to when you talk about him lying, you've basically put a camera in his taxi cab. He's a professional taxi cab driver during the making of your documentary. And so you have a camera in there so we can see him interacting with his passengers. And he's always trying to bargain them up so that they pay more and so on. But there's one scene where somebody gets in and says, well, what's this camera for? Like, why are you filming with me? What's this about? And tell us what he says in response.
Mm-hmm. So, a passenger gets in and he's talking about the camera and he just like, oh, well, this is, there's an American company making a film about the economic plight of Yemenis and the camera's not, it's not on. And the lie goes on. He's like, it's not rolling, the battery's died. And he does it, this lie is so seamless and it's so protracted that that it's this moment where we're telling the viewer, okay, we're turning here and we're asking you to question what it is that you're going to hear. And it's an important part of the film. And it's, it's really, although the film deals with, sort of these big issues, it ultimately in the end is a psychological, portrait or mystery, inside the mind of this man who is driving a taxi cab. And what Jonathan Oppenheim, the editor, and I were very interested in is, you know, we're very aware that the audience is constantly questioning him, right? Like questioning, you know, why is he speaking? You know, why is she getting this access? You know, how is it possible that this guy is free? I mean, there's so many sort of subtexts that are constantly running throughout this film. So that's really part of the story is sort of shaping that, you know, the journey into this man's world.
Will you show the ease with which he can lie? But I'm wondering why the passenger was in that position in the first place.
Actually, the way that it worked is that there's a camera that's mounted in the cab, and it's focused only on him, so you don't see the passengers. So we just told him to drive and do his job, and then I would go in and, you know, set focus.
Wait. Hang on. Mm-hmm. You're talking about Yemen, where, mm-hmm. you know, there are so many terrorists, and there's such suspicion that people are spies or terrorists, mm-hmm. and you've got a camera planted in a taxi without any real explanation. You're just telling the cab driver to, mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. just like tell people. I mean, you're almost setting him up to lie. What's he going to do? Tell the truth to the passengers that you're making a documentary about somebody who was interrogated by American intelligence and gave up the information about who the 9/11 hijackers were?
Right. You know, I actually, you know, I didn't tell Abu Jandal to lie or not to lie. I told him, just do your job. And then we find out he tells, you know, as we sort of saw the tapes later, that there are many different stories. There's another story where he says they're making a film about Guantanamo and they want to get public opinion about from Yemenis about what's happening in Guantanamo. So each story is different. I mean, I should say that this was a risky film to make and had to be made pretty much under the radar. So Abu Jandal, you know, he's concerned about his safety from the younger generation of Al-Qaeda. And so for him to be driving through the streets of Yemen, you know, with a small camera in his cab, I think, you know, made him a little nervous. But, it was fascinating to see how he, you know, he handled each situation. I mean, these interactions with his passengers are quite fascinating. You know, they're oftentimes negotiations about fares, you know, whether or not he's getting, you know, what he thinks is the right amount. And then also this telling of the story of why the camera's there.
But is it really a tip-off of who he is, then, if you've put him in a position where he basically has to lie?
Oh, actually, I do think it's a good tip-off of who he is, because I think it shows that he's very good at
he knows how to do it.
He knows how to do it, and I think that is actually quite revealing.
So I'm wondering what it was like for you to film in Yemen. I mean, the mm-hmm. women in Yemen that we see are wearing, you know, full burqa. All you see is their eyes. So there you are, a Western woman doing a documentary about a man, Abu Jandal, who some young jihadis would like to assassinate, even though Abu Jandal used to be very close to bin Laden. So what was it like for you to get around mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. Yemen?
Well, I mean, I made a film earlier about the war in Iraq, and that was a very dangerous place to work. And Yemen had its dangers as well, but I felt I had more freedom of movement. I was the way that I work in the field is I work alone, so I do my own camera and sound work, and I was renting a house. And I would go to the market, I would take taxis and film.
Wearing what? Wearing Western clothes?
Well, yeah, I would dress conservatively, but you didn't have to cover. It's not like Saudi, uh-huh. where if you're not covered, you know, you'll be stopped on the street. But I would tend to be relatively conservative. It seemed to be, you know, respectful, and I tried to stay away from too many, you know, Western establishments because foreigners are targeted. Being an American, you're targeted, so I tried to stay under the radar. And it was, of course, I worried. You know, I mean, I remember the first time that I went to film in his house, and I was going to film. There's a prayer scene where he it starts at 4:30 in the morning, so that was a situation I needed to be there the night before. And I remember being quite nervous getting into his car. Like, what am I doing? You know, how am I going to this house and filming this? And I couldn't not be worrying about those things. And yet, you know, I also felt that being a journalist gives me some kinds of protections in terms of doing this work. So, but in terms of being a woman, what I find is that as a Western woman, you can kind of move. It's a very gender-segregated society, but as a Western woman, you get to move between the two worlds. Most of the film is mostly men, so I would be in those situations, and I'd be allowed in them because I was Western. But then I also can hang out in the house and be with the women, and, you know, the thing that I couldn't do is film their faces, which was sad. I would have liked them to be a larger presence in the film, but that wasn't possible because of... But, you know, when I'm at their house, they're not covering. It's when the camera comes out that women have to cover their faces.
Laura Poitras, thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with the film.
Thank you so much.
Laura Poitras directed the new documentary, The Oath. You can see several clips from The Oath on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.